Hello and welcome to the In the Zone podcast with Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
And today also with Rosie Mutton. Hello, Rosie.
Hello.
Hello. We're going to talk today about terrorism and technology and the gap between terrorists and the state.
Yeah, so kind of for the past few decades, kind of the state has always been the most technologically advanced kind of entity. Well, because of various sort of things like Moore's Law. So Moore's Law is where the amount of, because of like miniaturization in technology, the amount of processors you can get on a microchip seems to double roughly every 2 years to 18 months. So that means that all of our computers get twice as fast in the same time, roughly. And because then you can just go out and buy a new computer, you can the computer processing power that you have as an individual kind of goes up and up and up at an exponential rate. So that means that, and plus other, for other things, like technology companies that kind of, like Apple and Microsoft and Google, kind of they're becoming so technologically advanced, they're becoming more advanced than the states. I mean, states as political entities, not the states as the United States. So both of them together kind of lead to a conclusion that eventually terrorist groups or individuals or kind of private groups will become as technologically advanced and capable as states. And so I was sort of thinking, well, what does that mean if that happens or when that happens? What kind of the implications of it?
Yeah, and I mean, that also ties in with drones as well. Because I know, Josh, we've talked a lot about drones. I don't know if drones comes into anything that you've done at all, Rosie.
Not so much, but I know that, you know, people have them now, and Amazon and delivering with them.
And this is part of the thing, because I read some stuff called swarm troopers, among other things. This idea that, well, obviously the US has its massive, great, big, really expensive drones that they don't get that much better for the amount of extra money they spend on them. Mm. But the thing is, any one of us now could go out and buy a drone, and if we got another friend, the four of us could pilot four drones, which could be used like a swarm almost. I mean, it's not quite swarm thinking, but we could pilot them like that.
Yeah.
And we could cause a lot of damage with those drones. I mean, strap an explosive to a drone.
Airports.
Like, or just fly them around an airport and like bring the UK to a standstill.
Yeah,
I mean, so I was watching a programme last night about it, actually, which is why I thought of this topic. because the idea of the programme was thinking about nefarious civilians who buy a drone off Amazon and what could they do with them. So obviously, kind of at Gatwick a few months ago, there was somebody threw a drone around the airport and ended up grounding all the flights for two and a half days, something like that.
Yeah.
And then kind of the RAF had to turn up with something impressive that kind of jammed the signal. Then this program looked at various other kind of things. So like using lasers to shoot them down and stuff like that, which is quite cool. Because if you've got a drone that's remote control, then you can jam the signal. If you know, the next generation of drones are going to be kind of autonomous, and so won't have a communication
themselves, basically. Yeah.
So you can't jam the signal because there isn't one. So kind of this technology, what was it from Raytheon in the US, the defense manufacturer, they sell something to the US military whereby kind of it's got a big camera on the front, and it detects the drone, and then it fires a laser, and it melts the drone in there, and then it drops to the ground. So obviously, kind of at the moment, so although we can kind of think about the capabilities that terrorist groups might have, or any nefarious individual, kind of, you know, they could buy a drone off Amazon and then do something bad with it. And at the moment, states kind of have still got the upper hand because they've kind of got counter drone technology available to them. But kind of what if, you know, kind of the drones that you can just buy off Amazon or wherever kind of start to be able to, maybe they can move faster than the kind of the anti-drone technology, or...
Or you've got enough drones to overwhelm the system, which is the whole swarm idea.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I know we were thinking about drones thinking for themselves, like you were saying, but wasn't there a study where the concept was that if you had enough drones, they did a study of drones attacking, I think it was a Navy destroyer, with like all the advanced anti-aircraft guns and stuff like this. And I think the study, this research institute, was like you'd need eight drones, eight small sort of portable drones, for at least 50% to be able to get through the defences, for like four to get through, with a hand grenade-sized explosive to do enough damage to disable the ship. So eight drones.
That's not a lot.
So we could just get a couple of friends, buy a couple of drones.
I suppose that's the thing, is that although kind of the question that I've posed is about thinking about states and territories being on equal footing in terms of their technological capability, but actually it doesn't necessarily have to be that way to have sort of similar destructive effects, does it?
No.
Because the thing is that whereas states, when state militaries kind of develop new weapons or new technologies, they develop them in such a way that they're reliable and they work every time and in a predictable way, whereas a terrorist group only needs it to work once.
That's true.
So,
yes.
And they disrupt the technologies. They don't necessarily need the most advanced technology either. So I was thinking about your research, Rosie, on like sort of the terrorist cells that you look at and things, something like sort of suicide bombers and things. Mm-hmm. I mean, explosives are fairly simple
devices. Although they do go wrong sometimes.
They do go wrong, but several, when they go wrong, yeah. That's kind of they're supposed to. Like, but I know they don't, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
in a way, going wrong is going right, but it's not going right.
Well, yeah, because if a suicide bomber is strapped up and it goes off before they get to their target, it's kind of they've still demonstrated their capability, haven't they?
True.
And they still kill people.
And they still kill Probably. People, maybe.
Then what I was thinking of was bomb carriers for the IRA, where the intention wasn't to be a suicide bomber, but when they detonate early accidentally, and you end up killing the members that weren't supposed to be killed.
Yeah, that happens in a Joseph Conrad book, The Secret Agent. Just bringing a bit of English literature to the story. my own field. That happens. That, like, a boy is used, sort of like, just send him off with the explosive. He doesn't know anything about it, but he goes off while he's carrying it, and then suddenly they've killed a civilian.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's not terrorism anymore, it's something different. Side note there.
Yeah. But, interesting side note.
Yeah, but the idea being that terrorists, sort of individuals or unscrupulous individuals, can cause more harm than perhaps
ever before.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's now, 18 years later, there is people are, or researchers, moving towards sort of saying that 9/11 was basically a fluke for Al Qaeda, and that it was, they didn't realise it could have been so
successful
for Al-Qaeda's aims. The fact that they killed so many people was like a massive blip, if you like, if you look back across the history of terrorism. And there's sort of research that says, well, you know, in the 1960s there was quite a lot of, well, several groups within America that killed, there was like several bombs every year that killed civilians, but because it wasn't as many people in one go, the sort of way that they're looked at these days is that they weren't as dangerous. But the fact that Al Qaeda managed to, if you like, pull off such a sophisticated attack, that's kind of been seen as the norm, but it's not. So
I mean one of the things they, inverted commas, benefited from was the sort of the iconic nature of the attack, in a sense of like the Twin Towers and the plane crashing into it. But if we're brutally sort of utilitarian about the answer, if you think sort of 5,000 people died, in the scheme of things, is that how many is that really? Because I heard something recently in a debate about the IRA, actually, and the amount of people that the IRA killed or who died in the Troubles.
Yeah.
And someone was saying, well, actually, if you look at the number of road deaths in Ireland and Northern Ireland over that period of time, more people died on the roads. So therefore, someone was arguing, well, was it even a civil... Because someone was arguing whether it was a civil war or not.
Right.
Okay. And they were saying, well, if more people died on the roads in sort of natural causes, does that then mean that it was actually really a sort of a civil war? Or was it... How do you define terrorism, which sort of links to our previous podcast?
Well, there is a sort of linked factoid in that... After 9/11, lots of flights were grounded, and also lots of people became scared of flying.
Yeah.
So they drove, more people drove everywhere, which created a lot more road deaths. In fact, more road deaths than were killed on 9/11.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like an unintended consequence.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I don't think that Al Qaeda planned it. But,
no, I don't think they could have foreseen that.
So it's quite... Which I suppose links back to something we've spoken about a few times on the podcast about unintended consequences. Also in that, if we kind of link it back to technology... It's not necessarily the technology that that's being used that's kind of that might be the most determinative aspect of kind of benefits or like that.
There's a big role of chance. I think chance is a big
chance. Yeah. Well, as you said, 9/11 was, is now generally thought to be a fluke.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they failed in 1993 with a truck bomb.
Yeah.
The same,
they did.
At the World Trade Center as well.
Yeah.
So.
They did get the World Trade Center.
It's kind of. But then I suppose kind of the worry is that. If terrorist groups have more and more advanced technologies, kind of enables them to do things, do more things at less kind of expense, and also kind of maybe more chance of success. Cause
but then you could also think about how, well, certainly Islamic State in more recent years, the attacks that happened in UK, France, Germany with the Christmas market, that was very low tech. Mm. That was driving a truck into a crowd of people and then getting out and stabbing people. So you can also think about that as a sort of flip side of it. That
and people have been able to do that since cars were invented.
Well, yeah.
Mm. Ultimately. I
mean, theoretically, yes.
Yeah, could but it's they. Just it's become a thing more recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that kind of it highlights the current gap in sophistication, doesn't it, between the fact that terrorist groups now, or at the moment, can no longer kind of do quite sophisticated things because security services and whoever have actually quite sophisticated tracking technologies and that type of thing.
That's
so in that kind of, so I suppose then you can see, yeah, again, unintended consequences of, you know, of preventing terrorist groups going for high tech things, it kind of forced them to go to low tech.
So they can sort of, in a way, have smaller, well, they could have more attacks that result in smaller, fewer deaths than say 9/11, but still they can sort of up the
it's the death by a thousand cuts kind of idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it opens itself up to copycats, whereas I suppose 9/11 doesn't so much. I think it's quite easy for someone to get in a van and just drive it down the street.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that in a way, because that opens up the possibility that anyone in a van at any time could be a killer. Like, and that, which is even more scary in a way if you think about it.
That's true, because obviously it's, you know, roads are everywhere and people are driving.
Yeah, and which plays into the whole discourse of sort of being wary of Muslims, as it were. Like, at the time, that was a thing that sort of really came out of 9/11, which was really sort of obviously very negative for the Islamic community. But this was sort of playing into hands of the sort of nationalist groups, wasn't it? And
I suppose it's interesting now that cause there was something on the news of the day about the far right is the far right terrorism is the fastest growing threat.
That's true.
To the UK at the moment.
And
people
I mean,
don't
think
really
about
think about the far right that often. The focus is much more on.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a few years ago. I think it might have been when Prevent. I think it might have been or something around the time. Mm. And someone was criticising it, saying, "This is basically just a document that focuses on Islamic terrorism, and the far right is just a cursory." Kind of let's pretend we're not racist kind of section that we've included. And whether it was true or not at the time, you can't deny that the far right has made a resurgence and a violent resurgence as well.
Mm. Well, especially in America. I mean, because that's the thing. I mean, the thing with America though is obviously they have high school shootings every other day. It seems
like
because they have weapons, not just automatic weapons. They have weapons everywhere. But there's a lot. It seems to me like there's an increasing number of far right white extremists shootings in America.
And I suppose kind of the American experience highlights kind of the slightly smaller gap between what the private individual can do and the state can do.
Yeah.
Because obviously they could buy quite high-powered weapons quite easily.
Hmm.
I think it was like in the 90s, I think, so there was like a bank robbery and two guys kind of robbed this bank. But basically they bought like body armour and high-powered assault rifles from, you know, the gun shop down the road, and kind of the police were armed with shotguns basically, so couldn't get close. So because they were being fired upon by high-powered assault rifles, they couldn't get close enough to use their shotguns. They also didn't have any body armor, and so I think that was the moment, or that kind of led to the creation of like the SWAT team, or at least kind of brought them into kind of the idea that every sort of city and every area needs them, and that type of thing. Which also makes me think about kind of the Munich massacre in 1972, at the Munich Olympics, kind of when the PLO was it, or a Palestinian group.
Yeah, there are many.
You know, quite a few. killed a bunch of Israeli Olympians, and that kind of brought on the idea that states need to have kind of a specialised counter-terrorist force, isn't it? Mm. So kind of in that sense, the maybe not the gap between the terrorists and the state was, I suppose. Well, Germany's in particular at the time is a very interesting case because they weren't allowed to have a counter-terrorist military force because of following the war. So it had to be border guards who had to be captured. Anyway, that kind of highlights that there was a very small gap between what the terrorists could do and what the German state at the time was capable of responding with. Whereas now it's probably quite wide. If you turn up with a gun in a street, kind of quite soon, a police armed response unit is going to turn up and do something about it. So I suppose maybe kind of the gap, as terrorists become more and more sophisticated, kind of the gap shrinks, and then there's kind of, God, they can do all this now.
Yeah.
Let's do some more. And then the state kind of invests in itself, basically, I guess is what I'm thinking. And then kind of the gap widens, and then maybe it's a cycle.
Maybe it is a continuous winding and closing and widening.
There's a piece of research we could do.
There's a piece of research. Yeah, let's do it. I was just thinking, guys, if we maybe move beyond guns, I was thinking about the sort of cyber domain particularly. Because, I mean, we've mentioned this numerous times on the podcast, talking about the sort of the bedroom warriors, be it autistic kids with like too much time on their hands, hacking into NASA and like the NSA or whatever, or state-sponsored actions like maybe China, Russia, rooms for the people. I mean, I'm also thinking, what was it I watched recently? Ready Player One, where you've got the corporation basically of hiring sort of teams of individuals to sort of play in the game to break the game. But the idea being it's a similar sort of thing. You could sort of fill a room full of computer experts to sort of spend their time infiltrating various sort of computer networks and causing damage without anyone ever knowing. That's another gap, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it kind of just made me think then about our podcast with Ben a little while ago on e-voting. And one of the things that he was talking about was kind of the amount of people who would really understand kind of an electronic voting system for electing the prime, a general election or something. Mm. The amount of people who kind of fully understand that system would probably be in the single figures. Mm. But say if you sort of think about a similar level of expertise when it comes to cyber hacking and cyber warfare and that type of thing, the figures must be quite low. So probably the state would probably know them all, but actually, are they all going to work for the state? Probably not.
I suppose it would depend if it was in their personal interests, I guess. I suppose it would depend what they, if they had an aim for hacking, if they were hacking against the state, was it whistleblowing kind of thing, or was it more just to get money, or... I suppose if they're principled and they've got sort of...
An ethical hacker.
If they're an ethical hacker, then maybe it might be more difficult for the state to get them on side.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a big case with hackers, isn't there? Especially with the sort of the autistic kids in bedrooms, using that as an example, where a lot of the big tech companies now, they sort of almost have a bounty, don't they, for hackers? Mm. It's like, you hack our systems, we basically give you a job.
Yeah.
Which is their way around the hackers. Make it better, sort of. You expose exploits.
Yeah. So I suppose that's interesting, because then... The gap isn't between the hacker and the state, it's between the hacker and the corporation, isn't it?
But then also the link between the corporation and the state, because, I mean, we've got this with Huawei at the moment, where there's a big controversy over whether we should be using Huawei, who are sort of Chinese, sort of, maybe implicated in state surveillance, we're not sure. But there's a big sort of controversy over whether we should be using them or not, and then are we letting the Chinese into our systems by letting Huawei get involved? But then what happens if we're letting Amazon... cloud services or whatever other big business have access to our information.
I suppose it all relates to privacy and the sort of what you sort of like that whole once you delete something like a photo it's still actually on
never
the cloud
really deleted,
that kind of thing, which is a bit
Mark Zuckerberg's looking at your old selfies
but obviously there is a thing then where how do you hold these companies to account? Actually, there's a big sense, I think, now that companies are becoming bigger and more powerful in the States.
Hmm.
I mean, Mark Zuckerberg can decide not to turn up to, an inquiry here in the House of Commons or whatever, but, if we called another minister from another country, you bet they probably would turn up.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it also relates to Apple after the San Bernardino shooting.
Yeah.
The police wanted Apple to unlock
phones,
the phone, but they said no because it was, privacy of the customer sort of thing. But then, did it get around that in the end? I think, but it was
after a long time. Yeah, after which time it becomes irrelevant.
Well, yeah. And
I think that's kind of the thing, isn't it? It's a bit like a bike lock. Because I remember when I go into my bike lock, and the guy in the shop said, if someone's going to try and steal your bike, they'll get through it. But you need a lock that's good enough that takes them so long to get through it that someone's going to turn up and catch them at it. So, there's a bike lock factor for everybody.
That gets more complicated with motorbikes these days, because it's almost turned into an actual, like a business. Because my dad's a bit of a biker and he's always going on about this. But with motorbikes, the people come fully equipped. Like, they have, like, they're not just like, oh, I'll see a bike lying around, I'll just pick it up. It's not a spur of the moment. They're actually targeting expensive bikes. And they go along with the kit with, like, the proper cutters and stuff, so they can sort of lift it up. And even if it's properly locked up, they'll just put it on the back of something and ship it away to then try and break into it. So, so what you're talking about will maybe ward off the impulsive spur of the moment.
So what, kind of stealing a bike from the way that you're talking about, motorbikes in the way you're talking about, kind of shows that actually not only is there no longer a gap between kind of the criminals and kind of the preventive action, but actually the criminals have gone ahead.
In a way, yeah. But that's because...
you just pick it up.
Yeah, the technology is there. You can easily buy a sort of tipper truck, can't you, and some cutting equipment and just get a gang of mates who can sell bikes to other people.
So in that sense, maybe I've posed the wrong question all along. It's not necessarily the technology, but it's access to the technology.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's probably a good shout.
Yeah.
In your research, because you look at sort of terrorist groups, Rosie, is there a sense that the technology is really enabling them more than perhaps it has in the past? Is it changing the way they work?
Certainly, thinking off the top of my head, to do with female recruiters in Islamic State. So because of the way kind of the social norms within Islamic State, women aren't allowed outside the house without a male guardian. Theoretically they would not be able to perform a traditional kind of recruiter role of going out and finding some people. But having access to the internet and social media means they can perform a recruiter role by getting in touch with people transnationally whilst remaining situated within the private sphere, which is where they're supposed to be located, if you like. So it's facilitating different roles for women, certainly. And then in terms of capabilities, I think you can compare the sort of propaganda that's put out by Islamic State by a group, say Tamil Tigers, from who were active more in the 80s and 90s, when there wasn't that relied on people putting out leaflets in
word
schools.
Word of mouth and things, yeah.
And being physically close to the community or population you were trying to target, whereas with Islamic State and other groups that use social media, they can be located wherever and, theoretically be in contact with anyone around.
The internet's been a massive factor, I think.
Disruptive technology.
Well, yeah, because on the one hand, it's bringing the world together, and so you say, well, it's a really good thing.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, by bringing people together, it means that some terrorist on the other side of the world can recruit some sort of school kids from over here, and they can go off and fight for ISIS. Which is scary stuff, really.
Absolutely, yeah. It's, I suppose, unintended consequences again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which reminds me of Paul Virilio is like a Pure War, and does like a lot of work on the sort of politics of speed. One of the things that he sort of said was, the invention of the ship is the invention of the shipwreck, and every technology has its own inherent negativity.
Yeah,
and I suppose kind of we're seeing kind of the manifestation of some of those negativities today and the past sort of few years, aren't we? Really?
Have you ever read? I think it's 23 things they don't tell you about capitalism.
I think I have. Yeah.
So, and it's.
I'm just going to look up that now because I can't pronounce the guy's name. I do know exactly the book.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting because it talks about how you might think that, the internet is the thing that has, done the most to help the.
Ha Jun Chang.
Yes. Thank you very much. Has done the most to sort of help get people into the labour market. But he's arguing that actually it was the invention of the washing machine because women did not have to spend so long washing clothes. They could then, they had more time to do do other things, and including getting jobs and things like that, because washing was so much easier.
Hmm. And so washing machines have effectively changed our world more than the internet. Yes and no. I think maybe you could argue against him. I think he is coming from a very specific philosophical sort of critical perspective. But he is making some interesting points, like the way maybe we overstate certain technologies. And as you say, because things are actually... people can still go out and bike. Maybe the motor car is more important, maybe, than the sort of the cruise missile when it comes to deaths and the use of terrorists, because people use cars to drive places.
Yeah.
They use cars to rob banks. I'm just to give another example of how maybe it's actually the simpler technologies, relatively speaking, that are the ones that...
Yeah, well, I recently read Freakonomics.
Yeah.
And in that kind of... one of the writers is an economist and one of the writers is a journalist. But the economist kind of makes this argument that... I mean, in the 90s, there was a massive reduction in crime in the US.
Yeah.
And he suggests that, and lots of people kind of come up with all these interesting kind of theories about why, and it's like, oh, this particular police office, this police chief kind of had these really, you know, good ideas and revolutionized kind of policing in New York City and all this kind of stuff. And he said, no, it's not that at all. It's women having access to abortions. Because then that meant, because a lot of the women who had abortions were the kind of from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And that's where a lot of would-be criminals would come from. So basically, the criminals who would have committed a lot of crime were never born.
Oh.
And that therefore leads to less crime, you know, 20 years on.
Oh, wow.
Or less crime to fund the kids, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, so... that's again, it's kind of unintended consequences. Yay. That's kind of got to be the theme of this podcast. But, I suppose in that sense, it's not... kind of when we think about technologies that affect terrorism or affect crime or affect negative things in society, it's actually very difficult to think about the implications of it, but also kind of causes of things things in society as well, isn't it?
And maybe the inequalities that the technologies bring about as well, leading to the ideological drives behind some of these terrorist organisations.
Well, there's not really, there was a point where people were profiling terrorists as those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who weren't as educated, but actually that doesn't really hold true anymore, and actually quite a lot of people are educated, like attended university level sort of thing, middle class jobs. I think in Japan, there was a group called Shinrikyo, and the majority of their members were university educated. I mean, they were more of a religious cult than a terrorist group, but they did release the sarin gas on the subway and kill some people. The majority of their members were from middle class sort of. Had jobs in sort of administration, that sort of thing. So they would have had access to technology things, so that's quite an interesting thing to think about, whether that is still, because I guess technology, I suppose, is, well, on a basic level, it's much easier to access than before, I suppose.
I was just thinking in terms of how some of these groups use the inequality between nations to sort of justify, the Americans are oppressing us. Because in a way, over a long period of history, the Americans have perhaps used their technological superiority to be able to build those inequalities. It's interesting how the technology does sort of come into it, I think.
I think it's interesting, because I was reading something the other week about sort of psychology and society, and it was basically sort of saying that for most people, inequality isn't necessarily bad, because if you see someone doing better than you, it's kind of actually quite encouraging. If they can do that, so can I.
Like a motivator.
Yeah. But where inequality becomes sort of psychologically sort of a negative effect is if you think that people who are ahead of you aren't sort of playing the game fairly. And so it's kind of the game is biased towards them and you're losing out. So I suppose in that sense, it would be quite, you know, if you see American kind of global imperialism, you know, and you live in a village in wherever, you know, in another country, and you kind of see America or the West as kind of being this dominating force that is sort of neo-colonial, when it's quite obvious that you would think, this isn't fair and I'm going to be angry about it.
Or the leaders are harnessing it for their own sort of ideological gains, their political purposes.
That's
Or if they're living somewhere that's you know, really feeling the effects of climate change because of all the industrialisation, pollution, and everything, when they haven't got that, when there doesn't actually have that those technologies as well.
Yeah, because obviously the climate change being caused by us who've been through the Industrial Revolution, where these countries haven't really got to that phase yet.
Yeah.
So it's like they don't even get a chance at that because we've already done it and used up all the oil.
And said, and no, it's, this is a bad thing now. Yeah. No one should do this before they've sort of reached that.
So we might see the kind of the re-energisation of eco-terrorism.
Ooh, maybe.
Oh, wow, that's another topic for a podcast, I think. Yeah. Eco-terrorism.
That would be quite interesting. I'm not sure if there are any existing ones.
I think there were a few, weren't there?
Well, we've had all these people arrested recently, haven't we, for the climate change protests?
Yeah, but
I mean, it's not terrorism yet. I know where you're
quite,
going.
Quite different from that,
No, but I mean, it's just, I mean, I'm just thinking maybe would it be the tip of the iceberg? Is that the start? Once people become mobilised...
Well,
and they've got access to technology. I mean, the drones is the big good example because
I suppose,
anyone can shut down an airport.
There was a thing, wasn't there kind of a plan to shut down Heathrow with drones by kind of Extinction Rebellion? Some way of shutting Heathrow down, I'm not sure it was.
They got arrested recently,
There was at least a plan that was in the news, and I don't think it actually happened, but the fact that they were willing to do it and capable of doing it. Which is sort of, it links to something that Steven Pinker talks about in his book Enlightenment Now. He sort of says when it comes to kind of highly advanced technological terrorist plots, well, actually, the number of people who kind of have the technical know-how to do something, like something highly advanced, like building their own drones or autonomous weapons or whatever, or bombs, is very low. The number of people with terrorist inclinations to make them want to do something violent is also very low. So kind of the numbers of people in the middle of that Venn diagram are usually zero.
Yeah.
Actually. So we're kind of safe because not very many smart people want to become, not very many people who have terrorist inclinations are very smart enough to do it, and not many people who are smart enough to do it kind of have terrorist inclinations.
But as we said at the beginning of this podcast, a lot of stupid people can get in a car very easily and drive down High Street and kill a lot of people.
Yeah,
true.
So swings and roundabouts in a way. I mean,
I guess
you don't need to be advanced to kill people.
I suppose we were always kind of going to conclude this podcast not really with a proper answer, was it? It was such a divisive topic. But
no, but it's interesting, I think.
Absolutely.
I think you've almost got two ends of the spectrum, haven't you? You've got the terrorists that do subvert the current technology to cutting-edge stuff, but then also you've got this reversion to the very simple stuff that we're not guarded against, that we can't guard against, like knives and guns and cars.
Yeah.
Basically.
And they do... harness those, definitely.
And mobile phones.
Yeah,
that's something that's quite interesting. So I remember when I was reading about kind of terrorist groups during the Iraq War.
Okay.
And how kind of the American military was, because it was at the start of the Iraq War, it was still very hierarchical. And kind of during, they kind of realised that these terrorist groups are basically emailing each other and phoning each other up, and therefore becoming very networked.
Yeah.
And therefore have very quick access to communicating with each other. Whereas kind of the American military at the time, it's a very hierarchical, so you had to sort of, you know, pass a message up the chain of command, and it took a long time to get to the top and then back down or whatever. And so you get people like General Stanley McChrystal, who sort of turned his sort of special forces units that he commanded into this sort of networked force, and sort of went from like raiding two terrorist houses a week or something like that to like doing 10 a night or more. And so you kind of, then I suppose, so in that sense, I guess, Al Qaeda in Iraq at the time kind of were using less advanced technology, but using it better.
Yeah, more effectively.
Yeah,
sort of.
And then so it kind of they created a gap between themselves and kind of the Americans or the coalition, and then so it was the coalition that was playing catch up.
Yeah, that's the point.
It's interesting.
So it's not just the technology; it's the use to which it is put.
Yeah. I suppose it's also. This also kind of links back to Paul Virilio in Speed, because one of the ways in which, well, the main kind of approach to tackling a terrorist network is not obviously to meet them in the battlefield, but it's to kind of to knock out nodes of the network.
Yeah.
And you have to do it faster than they can replace them, so then the network collapses.
According to him.
According to him. Well, he did work, so I believe him on that bit.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, does that, because we talked about the, was it the drug barons, and like, if you kill all the drug barons, then actually it gets worse, doesn't it? Because then the ones that are more, even more aggressive take over because they want to reach higher up, don't they? But there are sort of, I say, there's multiple facets to that particular argument. Yeah, but.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think that sort of brings us nicely to a conclusion of sorts. Well, I don't know what the conclusion was. In this particular case, it was just like, well, it's how you use the technology and
effectiveness of it.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. Thank you very much, and thanks, Rosie,
for joining
us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.